I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour says over the past two decades, school discipline has grown increasingly harsh and impersonal. Many schools and states are willing to exclude temporarily and permanently students for almost any type of behavior, even when it poses no real danger to school and provides the type of and involves the type of immature mischief that parents expect of normally developing children. Schools dig in their heels and insist that they must banish students. Our guest is the author of Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. Derek Black is a professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law. I know we have many people who teach. We have many people who are having students, sons, daughters, grandchildren, neighbors in school, and so you'll have a lot to say about ending zero tolerance. And what is the best way? Teachers talk about this all the time. What's the best way to make sure that discipline helps children succeed rather than breaks them down? Professor Derek Black, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Thanks for having me on, Kathleen.
Yeah, thank you. So what happened over the past two decades? Why did discipline grow so harsh and impersonal, zero tolerance take over?
Well, I think there's two big flashpoints I would point to. And the first was the sort of spat of high-profile acts of violence in our schools, such as Columbine. Mm-hmm. And that really shook us up emotionally, I think, and also for legitimate reasons, violence had occurred. And so we responded with a set of harsher policies and a lot more money to put law enforcement in schools. So I think that's the first point. And then No Child Left Behind, I think, is the second big flashpoint, because that ends up putting pressure on schools from the other end of the spectrum. We need students to perform at a higher level on standardized tests, or we're going to take negative action against the school itself. We're going to shut it down. We're going to fire people, mm-hmm. all these sorts of things. And so this put schools in a place, in a position where they felt students had to perform on these tests, and any student, right, who put that better performance in jeopardy became a target in some respects.
And you tell some stories in this book that are just incredible. You would want to believe, well, this only has happened at one place in one school in the whole country, but it hasn't really. And the stories, let's hear a few of these, because I have a terrible sinking feeling they may be more widespread than we think. You may want to start with the story of the middle school student, I believe he was, whose friend had written a note saying she was contemplating suicide, and his response to that, and then the school's response to that.
Benjamin Ratner was a middle school student in Loudoun County, just outside of our nation's capital, and he had a friend, a female friend, who had experienced some emotional issues in the past and had been suicidal in the past, and she comes to school one Monday morning and says, I've been feeling suicidal this weekend, and I brought a knife to school, and I'm thinking about hurting myself. And he, like any good friend, says, "Can I help you?" And moreover, can I have the knife? And she says yes. And so she says, "It's in my locker, in my book binder." He goes to the locker, gets the book binder out. I don't even think he actually saw or touched the knife, but he puts that book binder into his own locker. And then, like any good middle school news. Spreads quickly, and the assistant principal finds out about it within an hour or two, and calls Benjamin to the office and asks him about the situation. And I think this is sort of a key moment in time. And Benjamin says, "Yes, I know where the knife is. It's in my locker." But the principal at that moment has no fear of Benjamin whatsoever. Doesn't think he's a threat. He actually says, "Can you go get it for me?" And I think that tells you something about the psychology of the school. So Benjamin goes, gets the knife, brings it back to the principal, and the principal says, "Benjamin, I'm sorry, you did the right thing, but I'm going to have to suspend you." Mm. So I'm sure Benjamin was a bit shook up, but things got worse, because when Benjamin got home later, his mother got a phone call, and they said, "We need you to come down to the district office, because, suspension isn't enough. We're planning to expel your son." And that's exactly what they did. And Benjamin's family fought back against this through the court system, and actually the courts were no more help than were the superintendent or the principals.
Mm. And you'll have to wonder what happened to the young girl who was going through such horrible times, and her friend was expelled from school who was trying to help her.
Well, and that's the other interesting part of the story, which I actually haven't emphasized in these talks before, is that Benjamin, in some sort of way, as a nascent psychologist, was actually trying to help, because his thought was, you know what, I'm not going to cover this up. He said his plan was to go home and tell his parents and her parents and let them come up with a plan for how to help. Right, and so he really, you know, at the bottom of his heart was trying to help, and even the school agreed he was trying to help, but that they were still going to expel him. And his story is not unusual. I mean, I will say one of the interesting parts of writing this book and talking to folks is, you know, I'm starting to get these phone calls of people telling me about their experiences, and I just got one the other day, you know, not quite as egregious as Benjamin's, but just, you know, I think his kid was in third grade, and I don't think he really did anything that serious, but he was really traumatized by the fact they had suspended him, because he thought of himself as being a good student, and now the school is saying, no, you're a bad student, and we're going to suspend you.
Mm-hmm. And you also write about the fact that once you have that first suspension, that pact that you have with your school, and that you're a member of a community, and the school community is broken, and the consequences are pretty dire for years to come.
That's right. I mean, there is the data strongly supports this sort of cascading set of negative effects. So one suspension, for whatever the behavior, one suspension drastically increases a second suspension within the next 6 to 12 months, and that additional suspension drastically increases the chance of dropout, which drastically increases the chance of incarceration and unemployment. So there really is this sort of connected stream that we call the schoolhouse to jailhouse pipeline. And that's the data. But I think what you're hitting on with your point is the sort of psychological element of it. That, you know, sure, there's a lot of kids that misbehave. Sure, a lot of them struggle in school. But, on average, or most of the time, they think of school as a place that's trying to help them, someone that's on their team. Now, they may not like that, right? Kids fight with their parents all the time, but they recognize that their parents are on their team. But when the school makes that decision to suspend a student, that idea, that concept of the school as sort of the benevolent educator changes. But this is someone that's throwing them away, and potentially for a very extended period of time. And once they do that and that bond is broken, the child actually has less incentive to conform his or her behavior to the school's expectations. Mm-hmm. And by the same token, once the school itself in its own mind says, you're worthy of exclusion, it becomes all the more easy for them to say you're worthy of exclusion again and again and again.
Most of us would probably agree, well, we would agree, that we don't want weapons in schools, we don't want drugs in schools. And I want to ask you a two-part question. How common are those, and would you say that schools are rightfully suspending students for having weapons or carrying drugs, although their definition of drugs, I know, varies. You write about that in the book. But you also say that there might be legitimate reasons, but today's schools are suspending and expelling students for almost anything, for truancy, cheating, running in the hall, dress code violations, foul language, disruption, and disrespect. So two parts. What is a fair suspension, and then why are we going to all these other things?
If a child brings what I think you and I would call a real weapon to school, if a child brings what I think you and I would call real drugs to school, I would allow that those children may need to be removed from the school. If they pose a threat to themselves, if they pose a threat to others, we need to remove them, right? We can't have that sort of dire mistake. But of the more than 3 million suspensions that our schools hand out a year, only somewhere between 5 and 10% are actually for drugs and weapons, which is to say more than 90% of these suspensions are for everyday misbehavior. And in those circumstances, it's hard for me to come up with a set of facts in which it is appropriate to exclude a child from school, much less expel them for the remainder of the school year. But yet that is what is happening on a regular basis.
Mm. Single suspensions, you talk about the academic attainment, the employment for a student, and that roughly 40%, you say, of student suspensions in any given school year are multiple suspensions. So you sort of get labeled as a troublemaker, it would appear to me, and get suspended the first time, and then everybody has eyes on you again and make sure that you get suspended a second time.
That's true. There's a couple different ways that breaks out. I mean, there's one way that breaks out, which is to say that some schools' primary method of dealing with everyday misbehavior is suspension. There are schools in our country, in our nation's capital, that hand out more suspensions in a single year than they have students. So there's, to be specific, a school with, let's say, 250 students that over the course of the year issues 500-some-odd suspensions. Right? And that is the primary way of dealing with misbehavior. Obviously, it's not working. I mean, I think the numbers themselves tell you it's not working, right? Because unless those suspension numbers are coming down over time, what we're doing is just kicking kids out. So we have that phenomenon. And then, as you say, once we suspend a kid one time, behavior is often in the gray area, right? Is that highly problematic? Is that acceptable? Can I tolerate that? I mean, for anyone that has a child, sometimes we just ignore misbehavior, right, and understand that kids can't be perfect all the time. Mm-hmm. But once a kid has been suspended once, the willingness to look the other way or to say that's not that serious goes way down, right? Because in your mind, you've already said, this is a troublemaker, right? And that's what makes the odds of suspension. That's part of what makes the odds of suspension go up. Because I'm not saying this is conscious, right? Sort of on a subconscious level, we have suspended the idea of this being a redeemable student, right? Mm-hmm. That this is now a student that we have to process out of this place. He or she is a troublemaker.
Do we have more suspensions now in schools that have police officers at the door? I know that there have been more of those. I wonder what the status is, if we have a lot of law enforcement in our schools, if it's necessary, and what that's done to the suspension rate.
You know, that's an excellent question. Probably the best one I've been asked in a month, because I can't answer it. I do not know how suspension and law enforcement presence correlate. What I do know more generally is that the presence of law enforcement does not produce sort of a more orderly environment. I think what we've seen in this past year, well, I should say it doesn't always. I'm sure sometimes it does. But, in this past year alone, a number of videotaped incidents of, these law enforcement officers actually acting violently towards students. And that has negative repercussions on the well-behaved students because, this is unsettling to see law enforcement acting violently towards your friend, towards your sister, towards someone you've gone to school with for 10 years. And so these students, their vision of school changes, right? This is a place where we're being policed and potentially subject to violence. And moreover, the teacher who I thought was a good guy or a good girl, he's the one that called the police on my friend and had him or her drug across the floor. So, unfortunately, there are these sort of incidental negative effects of harsh discipline and law enforcement that actually outweigh the benefits that we're purporting to seek.
Derek Black is our guest this hour. His book is Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. Derek is a professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law. So let's go to the audience. Tell me what it's like in your school district. Do you have a zero tolerance policy? How is it that, because teachers do encounter this, and what they want to do is be able to teach, and there are students who are disruptive. There may be some serious issues that are going on in schools that call for suspension. What would those issues be? How do you create, as our guest talked about, an orderly environment where learning is prized and where there aren't disruptions? We certainly welcome your phone calls. Zero tolerance, our guest writes, has changed at a number of major urban school districts in the country. They have come up with different kinds of policies because suspensions and expulsions had grown problematic in those districts. And so what are they doing now? And what should we all be doing now? What do you think? Here's how you let us know what you think. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We have lines open for you right now, and we'd love to hear from you. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have lines open for you right now, and we are speaking with the author of Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. Derek Black is our guest, and we go to Jacob in Minocqua, our first caller. Hi, Jacob.
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead.
Hi, yes. I have a six-year-old in MHLC Minocqua, and he's a good kid, but he gets upset about things. And the first time he got upset and ran out of the classroom, they suspended him for 3 days. He's been suspended four times now since the beginning of the school year, and the fourth time he actually got aggressive enough that he swung at a teacher, and they called the cops on my six-year-old boy. He's not a bad kid, but he knows that if he acts out, he gets sent home. He gets to spend a few days sitting on the couch, gets to go to work with me, gets to download Power Ranger videos. How is this helping him at all?
And what made him upset when he first ran out of the classroom, Jacob?
He doesn't like transitions. I think somebody had something that he wanted to play with and they were out of time, or he has a hard time coming back in from recess. But there's zero tolerance policy. They just kick him out. You know, I don't want anybody to beat my kid, but there has to be a line or something that can be done in
right.
school.
Right. It seems pretty dramatic, doesn't it, Derek, for a six-year-old to be suspended? It's only October, 12th or something, to be suspended that many times. The school year just started, and he's six.
First of all, I hate to hear that. I mean, as I was saying earlier, I get these stories, and then you hate to hear them. And the one thing that we do know about, kids, the age of Jacob's son, is that there is no evidence whatsoever to support a benefit of suspension for kids that are probably in third grade or younger. So there have been, about four or so states that have recently banned, at least banned expulsion. Some of them have banned suspension in those lower grades. Unfortunately, it sounds like Wisconsin is not one of those states yet, but New Jersey has done it. California has done it because the state legislature, which is not necessarily always the fountain of wisdom, has said, look, there's no benefit here. We're convinced. And so, unfortunately, I don't have a good answer other than to say that clearly other state legislatures recognize that's inappropriate. But I think his comment really hits on a key point, which is when I talk about misbehavior, I think when we talk about it, we have to really divide it into categories. There's a certain percentage of misbehavior that comes from the fact that students are experiencing poverty, homelessness, child abuse,
mm-hmm.
those
hunger.
Sorts of things. Hunger. And so that's one category. There's this other category of children who are struggling to learn. They're not keeping up with the material. It's not engaged in the right way. And so they are misdirecting their energy, so to speak. There's another category of kids who have some form of a disability, and either it be a learning or behavioral disability. And then there's this fourth category of kids who maybe they are just trying to cause trouble. Right, for no good reason. But those first three categories, as Jacob said, or alluded to with his own experience, suspension does nothing to respond to poverty, to respond to hunger, homelessness. It does nothing to respond to the fact that a child isn't learning well. It does nothing to respond to the fact that a child has a disability. So for those kids, what we are really doing is suspending them for the sake of suspending them. And that, I argue in the book, is completely irrational.
Thank you, Jacob, very much for your call. Matthew in Eau Claire, hi.
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 I just wanted to say when I was in high school, and this would be 2006, so not terribly long ago, I was just one of those guys that always had a pocket knife on me and tried to take it out before school, but just one day it didn't. Had it inside my backpack, and it fell out, and my band teacher saw it. He basically told me, he's like, I have no choice. I have to, just turn this in, tell the principal. And I was certain that I was going to be expelled, suspended, whatever punishment was going to be. But later that day, I got called into the principal's office, and he basically just said, you screwed up don't do it again. But he handed me the knife back and took me back to class, and that was it. So I mean, I couldn't be more thankful for that. It was incredible.
Yeah. Derek?
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, he actually reminded me not of a knife experience, but a bit of an experience where I didn't do so well on a quiz or a test when I was in eighth grade, and it was all my fault, completely my fault. But they gave me a pass, so to speak. And the amount of goodwill that they bought from me and how much it actually improved my behavior was actually quite incredible. And I get the sense from this caller that he was so thankful he was probably more careful. But I think his call, his point also, you know, brings out a couple of other stories, that one of which I talk about in the book and a recent one here in Minnesota, involving kids just like him who accidentally brought a knife to school. There's a kid in Tennessee, wasn't even his knife. His friend had left it under the seat. And I guess band directors have a nose for
I guess
for
they knives. Must, yeah.
But because they found his, too, under the seat. It was a band director that found it there in Knoxville, Tennessee. And the school, unlike the caller, the school insisted on expelling him. They said they had no choice, that there was a knife there. They had to draw a line in the sand. And literally, before the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Detroit, Michigan, said to the judges that the judge threw a hypothetical out there and said, well, you can't really mean you're going to draw a line in the sand and expel everyone no matter what. He said, what if the valedictorian was walking down the hall and one of the so-called bad kids took his knife and slipped it into the backpack of the valedictorian without the valedictorian knowing? Are you telling me that you would still have to expel that kid? And the initial response was, yep, we would do that. Now, you know, the judges eventually got them to back off of that position, but I think it's very telling that there are so many administrators that insist, you know, that they're going to kick kids out no matter what, no matter what the circumstances, even if it doesn't make sense. There was a case just like the one of the caller in Minnesota recently. They did the same thing. Kid was working on a farm. He uses his knife to cut, cut the baling yarn or baling rope, I guess, for the hay, and had just slid it into his backpack as he was going back to the house. Showed up on Monday morning, sweep went through, and they expel him for it. Fortunately, the Minnesota Supreme Court a month ago stepped in and said, look, intent matters. Circumstances matter, and you can't just do that. But those are actually aberrations. Those are aberrations. Most of the time, administrators say, we refuse to exercise judgment. We must do this to you.
And so what is the, because obviously you don't want kids walking around with knives. I mean, I wouldn't feel comfortable with that in a school. I don't like weapons, and I wouldn't feel comfortable if I were a teacher in the classroom. So what would the, let's keep an orderly, safe school, the best response to that would be to take the knife?
Yeah, well, we get this sort of sense we have to do something to the kids. But as I tell folks, you know, our greatest national tragedy in the last 15 years happened with airplanes crashing into the World Trade Centers, right? But if you show up, I'm getting ready to go to the airport in a little while, if I show up with something in my bag that I'm not supposed to have, they don't throw me in jail. They don't put the handcuffs on me. They go, sir, did you know you had this in your bag? Oh, no, I didn't, or maybe I did, but I thought I could bring it. They go, well, we can throw it in the trash or we can send it home to you, right? So that clearly in this very dangerous situation, I put the airplanes were far more dangerous than our schools, that, you know, they realized that stuff happened. So in the school setting, yes, if it's an accident, you know, take it from them, right? I just think, now, certainly there are judgment calls there, right, that was it an accident? Was it not? Does this kid have ill intent? Does he or she not? I'm willing to defer to administrators to make that judgment. The problem is that we refuse to make judgment about kids, right? That we're just zero tolerance. The facts don't matter. The intent doesn't matter. And I would say that that's irrational.
Here's an interesting email from someone in Stevens Point. I'm the mother of a first grader. Since the beginning of the year, there's been a child in my son's class who's displayed violent behavior on the average of 3 days a week. Children have been physically hit by the child, as well as objects have been thrown by the child. Chairs have been thrown, desks overturned. The school and Stevens Point School District states they're in the process of testing and handling the situation. They also state the child has every right to be in the classroom. My heart goes out to the child and his family, but there is a classroom of children being exposed to explosive and violent behavior multiple times a week, and the school district keeps stalling. What do you say, Derek?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. We never can ignore the fact that what we do need at the end of the day are safe and orderly classrooms. And the question is, how do we get there? And one of the stories I hate to tell in the book is the fact that teachers in many of our schools today simply do not have the tools and resources to deal with disorderly classrooms. So when I critique zero tolerance, it is not a critique of our hardworking teachers, it's not a defense of misbehaving students. Over the last decade, over all 49 of 50 states cut their education budgets, and even today, 26 out of 50 are spending less on education today than they were before the recession. Right. So our classrooms are strapped. They are larger, and teachers
are
more underpaid. And so part of the solutions that to dealing with these are to what we call sort of positive behavioral interventions and supports. That if there's a student in a classroom like this, he clearly needs help. There's no doubt about that. And there are training, there are social workers, there are counselors, there are special ed teachers who can help improve that behavior or figure out what works for that young child. But in schools that lack resources, they cannot address that. So many of our schools are stuck in a very hard situation between simply kicking kids out of school and giving them the resources they need. This email might suggest, well, this kid is putting my child at risk. Let's kick them out. The problem is this kid is going to return. I mean, this is a first or second grader. They're not going to be done with him or her that quickly. So unless they devote the resources and time to address whatever his challenges are, this behavior is going to continue, and all the suspensions in the world are not going to improve his misbehavior. So unfortunately, it's either fix the problem or continue to suffer the repercussions of not fixing.
Yeah. Matt in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, Matt, how are you?
I'm good. Jacob, I'm really glad you brought up that point. I was one of those kids in school that, you know, did have a behavioral problem. I wouldn't say I had a learning disability, but, you know, I had the IEP set, which is the individual education plan. And, you know, you were singled out in the classrooms, and it was very embarrassing. And I'll go on public record and say that it was embarrassing for me coming through the school district, you know, with that individual education plan. You know, you're singled out. You're put in the classes with the disruptive kids. And my problem when I was going to school was that wasn't the environment into which let me flourish. It was, hey, let's get this classroom full of 30 bad kids, half of which are having a cigarette outside, the other half are not paying attention to the classroom, and the one-third that aren't causing a problem are causing a problem with the teacher. You know, we've kind of got, I don't know how it is, it's been 10, 15 years since I was in high school, how it's gotten, but, you know, I kind of feel like we've gotten away from the structure of the student and gone to the structure of, well, this is all we can do. And it wasn't until I was expelled and put into another program where I was put into these educational programs at the local technical college where I was able, you know, I think all of us on this call have been in college where you're able to have kind of this group learning where everybody learns from one another. Mm-hmm. Where there's kind of a goal, but everybody gets a chance to be a part of it. And I flourished in that. And then I got my HSED, and I was the fastest to do it in Wisconsin. And I went to college, and I got my degree. And it was how much time was wasted with these meetings, with singling me out in class. And I can't imagine the kids that are still going through that. How much time are we wasting doing these meetings rather than finding a way that works for all students? Imagine if we could get these troubled kids and get them to be part of the lesson.
I'm glad it worked out for you, Matt. That's a success story, certainly. I think it may be related to the fact that we don't have money to do that, right, Derek? We don't put the resources into making sure that students like, we find a path for students like Matt.
I think that's right. I mean, it is not easy. I think one of the things that I try to emphasize, though, is it's sort of the pay now or pay later. You can't get away from paying. And so what we have are discipline systems that, you know, let a kid continue to misbehave or low-level misbehavior, not big stuff. And they just ignore it, they ignore it, until they finally get tired of dealing with the student, maybe like Matt. Say, well, you've been doing this so much, we're tired of you, we're going to put you in this other special ed classroom, or we're tired of, we're going to put you to the alternative school. I think part of what positive behavioral supports and other sort of counseling services are about seeing that potential problem very early on, right, and starting to step in and try to figure out what's going on with that kid early, not at the back end once the teacher's tired of that student or the school's tired of them. The truth is that means more front-end work. But by doing that front-end work to figure out what motivates a child, what the problem is with a particular child, we then avoid that later sort of, heightened circumstance where the kid really has done something. And so, I think it is, unfortunately, a fact of sort of human biology that we like to defer things down the road, deal with the problem when it comes to us. But I think what we are learning is that to effectively deal with discipline, we address it early and often, not later points.
Thanks, Matt, for your call. Michael in Northeast Iowa. Hi, Michael.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to relativize the conversation a little bit. It's a very interesting topic, of course. Public education is both a laboratory and a microscope of social issues and social dynamics. I've taught in schools in the Midwest and in Germany, both as a classroom teacher and as a guest lecturer. Once even underwritten by Wisconsin Humanities. And my experience has been is that I experienced other teachers, other educators have told me, and I've seen this, that over the last 10, 15 years, there are a lot of children who are acting out. Of course, there have always been children with behavioral challenges. But what are some of these teachers supposed to do? And on the other hand, the speaker's certainly right. We have the zero tolerance policy. We've seen that in the so-called justice system. We've seen it in the so-called war on drugs. So we in America have this penchant for really puritanical, draconian responses, which in Germany I didn't see. Schools were a lot less likely to react with this sort of zero-tolerance mentality. So I want to relativize the discussion a little bit. It is a problem. Behavior, what are teachers supposed to do? Because in my experience, there are more children acting up with outrageous behaviors, absolutely unacceptable, outrageous. What do you do with them? Many times they are a danger to the other pupils and to the teacher.
Oh, that's a good question. Derek?
Well, I never try to bash, maybe it sounds like it, but I never about bashing teachers, because the answer is exactly what the caller suggests, which is teachers, as a general principle, are not the problem in many of schools. And if we've got kids in a classroom that are causing a disorderly environment and the school is not there giving the resources to help that teacher is stuck, right? If the rule was we're just going to have no suspensions and teacher, you deal with it, but we're not going to do anything extra, just no more suspensions, that would make things worse, quite clearly, right? Make things worse because we're just going to have disruption. It's going to get worse and worse in the classroom. So my point is, though, that we have to end zero tolerance and implement the support services and the positive behavioral supports to deal with student misbehavior. And that requires not just services. It requires giving teachers better classroom management skills and training so they can spot and give them strategies to deal with students, and we don't invest in that. So a teacher who hasn't been trained or a teacher who doesn't have those supports in their school, they are in a terrible position, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
But it's not, I guess I would add, and the fault lies with the state legislature. The fault lies with the school district, not with the school teacher.
Sue on Facebook writes this, and this will move us into a discussion of what works better. Behavior improves a lot when the students are treated with respect from adults. I mean, it's simple, but it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
It does, and I think actually when they respect one another, a lot of times we use this phrase positive behavioral supports, restorative justice, and probably many of the listeners are going, what in the heck is that guy talking about? Well, one concrete example is my son goes to a public Montessori school, and they have what is called a peace mat. If someone is doing something to disturb you, if someone has wronged you, or if you just want to talk about something, you have the right to go pull out the peace mat. lay it down on the floor, and the other person is obligated to sit down, look you in the face, and talk through that. Mm-hmm. These are children. These are, you know, my son's in second grade. And that's a beautiful idea. It's a simple idea.
Right.
And so, you know, we use these sort of fancy terms, but they're sort of, it is helping children develop and learn from conflict. And to be quite honest, that type of conversation on a peace mat is incredibly educational. I mean, what we're really trying to do is teach our children to be members of society, to be civil. And, you know, those are some of the most beautiful lessons we could teach them. Far more valuable, I would put to you, than memorizing spelling words
for
standardized tests.
I like this idea of peace mats. They can be all over our houses, too, with our children, right?
That's what most people say.
Even
yes,
adults.
A lot of families could use them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks very much, Michael, for your call. Jerry in Racine. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think another aspect we need to be looking at is parent involvement with the students. On a weekly basis with the teachers, with the principal. Right now, I have three sons going through the school system right now in high school, and it's amazing how many students are lacking parent involvement in a lot of things. Teachers are reaching out to parents, calling them, no one's answering, sending notes home. A lot of the, you know, things are being exhausted, and then they have to suspend the child, and then when they suspend the kid, even if they did something wrong, parents are like treated like customers, and they're going in there and they're yelling at their administrators about why are you suspending my children, and then they have to reverse it. So it kind of goes both ways. Some kids don't deserve to be suspended, but oftentimes when you got a classroom size of 30 to 40 students, average age between 16 and 18 years old, you kind of have to roll with a strong arm once in a while, because the kids can start running that school fairly quickly if you're not on top of it.
Derek.
Well, certainly the goal in all of school discipline is to provide a more orderly environment. And, you know, what all the data says is that if the way that we are trying to produce a more orderly environment is through suspension, we're going to make things worse. So, you know, we always have to address and try to make the environment better. And the question is, how do we do that? And what the data would tell us is that suspension doesn't do that. If we're comparing apples to apples, schools that deal with misbehavior in the classroom through means other than suspension, we compare those schools to schools that deal with it primarily through suspension. Those schools who take alternative routes actually have higher achieving students than those who use suspension. So none of this is about ignoring misbehavior. The question is, you know, how do we deal with it? Now, the caller also points out the sort of important role that parents play, and there is no doubt about it that, you know, the support that a child gets at home is affects how they're going to behave at school. And unfortunately, our schools are sort of where all of our societal ills play out. So when we've got parents working two and three jobs that just simply don't get to spend any time with their children, don't really participate in the education process, or parents who don't own cars, don't have money for transportation, can't come to school for a school meeting, those things negatively impact. But we can't simply throw up our hands and go, well, since this kid has a bad parent, we are not going to take the proactive steps that are going to help this student behave better in school. You know, that student, no matter what we do to them, is going to be a member of our society, either in or outside of school, are going to produce positive or negative consequences for our society.
Let's talk, just before we go back to phone calls, we have so many of them this hour. A number of major urban school districts you highlight in the book have taken formal steps to limit zero tolerance and don't want to turn their schoolhouse, you write, into a jailhouse pipeline. So between 2013 and 14, Chicago, L.A., New York City, Nashville joined the Positive and Safe Schools Advancing Greater Equity Initiative. What have they done? Has it been more successful than zero tolerance?
Yeah, and they have been implementing what we call the positive behavioral supports that try to identify the problem, to monitor the problem across time, to come up with individualized strategies for dealing with misbehavior of each individual child, to put the funds in place to train the teachers on how to do that, to have the counseling services in place when necessary to deal with that. So they are doing the things we talked about, and it costs money, and it is showing positive results in those schools. And you know, and the federal government is trying its best to, I shouldn't say it's trying its best, the federal government is supporting it in certain ways because we realize that this is really the only way forward to improve the achievement of all students and to bring down juvenile justice and incarceration problems.
Dean in Pulaski, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to say that I worked with kids from K through 12 for 20 years as a clinical social worker, and I was always confused as to why they didn't have programs in the school. I worked in a day treatment program for 12 years. I thought we had a lot of success. One of the problems was you had to take the child out of the school, and then we had a facility, and then, you know, you tried to get them back in. But I never understood why they wouldn't have the programs right in the school. And then when the child has a behavior problem, you know, they'd have a some sort of program to go to that could respond right away. And then I think a lot of times children, their behaviors are just their way of communicating. You know, if they got problems, they didn't eat, or they're afraid at night, they stayed up all night, you know, they came to school and slept the next day then, or whatever, you know. They're very serious problems. And, you know, you need to work with the child and then try to pull those parents in and work together with them. And it's not easy, but it can be done. You can work, you can save or help a lot of kids. You're not going to help them all. But, you know, and I think the money's there. It's just that we're very reactive instead of proactive. I mean, there seems to be enough money for prisons. We got 2 million people in this country in prison. But, you know, why don't we spend some of that money up front and help these kids not become angry at society? So that, again, I that's my comment.
Thank you. Thank you for your comment, Dean. Derek.
Yeah, two things. I mean, the first is, you know, I always worry when I'm, I appreciate all your callers. They've all been.
They're good, aren't they?
I always sort of, I always worry that people think, well, this is this sort of ivory tower academic who doesn't know what he's talking about. Come to the real world. And what I would say to them is that law enforcement is increasingly telling schools, stop calling us. Right, we can't make this better for you. And not only that, law enforcement at the national level has begun to advocate for more of the services like your caller just discussed. They're saying, look, you know, you either pay now or pay later. And if you're waiting to pay later, meaning pay the juvenile justice system, it's going to cost you a lot more than if you pay up front. So if you're worried about social services costs, the best money is going to be the money spent up front with kids. And so I think your caller is right on. And I think it's not ivory tower. Law enforcement is saying this in many jurisdictions. The second thing I would add is this sort of beautiful story beautiful in some respects that I heard about. I think it was through a New York City NPR affiliate about a school that was experiencing all sorts of problems with zero tolerance in New York City. And there was a mental health facility up the street and a counseling place up the street. And they said, you know what, we've got some extra time on our hands or a grant or something. You know, you can send us some of these kids if you want to, you know, and when you get to the breaking point. So they instituted through the policy that they would not automatically suspend and expel students for certain types of misbehavior. They'd send them up the street and see what happened. And in the first year that they did this, there was this one student who cursed a teacher, which in the prior year would have resulted in a long-term suspension. They said, you know what, that doesn't seem like him. Let's send him up the street. And, you know, that afternoon the kid disclosed that, you know, his father had been abusing him for an extended period of time and that whatever the teacher had said to him in the classroom reminded him of the way his dad made him feel. And that was his response. And so, I mean, I think, you know, that kid would have never opened up and told that. Well, I shouldn't say never. Very unlikely that they would have opened up and told that to someone without that sort of service. But I think the key there is what the caller said, was that it just so happened that that school had those services up the street. And I think the caller is saying, why don't we bring those services into the school so that we can deal with them quickly and immediately instead of leaving it to the random chance of someone up the street volunteering to help?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good story. Derek Black, author of Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline, is our guest. Our phone number, 800. Thank you, Dean, for your call, 486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go next to Lily in Lake Mills. Hi, Lily.
Hello.
Hi, Lily.
So I would like to tell a story. I'm in eighth grade now, but last year when I was in seventh grade, I grabbed a ton of my mom's like craft stuff, okay, like pencils, and then I got to school and I was putting it all out, and there was just happened to be this like pencil sharpener razor thing, and it was an inch and a half. It wasn't that big. You probably couldn't hurt anybody with it if you tried. I have no history of violence. And they knew it, and they didn't ask any questions, but they just sent me up to the office, and I was suspended. They didn't ask about anything. And it's just...
Yeah, and then did you your family, or did you have any recourse? Could you plead your case anywhere, Lily?
No, I couldn't. They just sent me up to the office, and I was sent home. They didn't ask my parents about anything.
And what did they say to you, that they had found this object, and what did they say?
They told us that since I had it, I had to be sent home because I was a danger to other kids, even though it was a complete accident. And if it had been 3 inches long, then I would have been permanently expelled.
Whoa.
For questions.
Whoa. Derek.
Yeah, I think that what we've seen with zero tolerance is, these administrators have the ability to make a judgment in a case such as hers, but they refuse to. They refuse to look at the facts. They simply say, did she have a sharp thing or not?
Right.
That's the only question they ask. And when the Supreme Court in 1972 said students are entitled to due process to figure out whether the punishment is justified, I think the question of whether it's justified requires looking into the facts and the circumstances a little bit. And our schools refuse to do so. I mean, I don't want to get into too much of the nuance here, but in the book I really talk about how our courts have to stand up for kids like her. When the political process in Wisconsin, the local school district, at the principal's office, refuses to recognize that she has a right to attend school, and the Wisconsin Constitution entitles her the right to go to school, right, that when the political process refuses to recognize that right and to give her a fair shake, so to speak, that our courts are there to protect those that no one else will protect. And so that's one of the arguments in my book, is that it's time for civil rights advocates and courts to step up and interrupt the political process that continues to throw away our children.
Yeah. Lily, thank you so much for your call. Joseph in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a quick comment. I'm an education major, and I hope to be entering the teacher profession within a year or so. And I have a concern as far as our schools seem to be maybe turning into some sort of economic machine, right? Get kids in and get them out as fast as possible so they can contribute to our economy. And my concern is that kids don't feel valued these days. I think they don't feel valued as just as people. And therefore, I think they act out because they feel like nobody really cares about them. And I think, as has been mentioned earlier in the show, as they continue to grow older and even into adults, they still have never really felt valued. And I think that leads to a lot of poor decisions, and then it also inhibits them from seeing the value in other people, so therefore making poor decisions with regards to social interactions with other people. So do you have any comments as far as, like, how do you make children feel valued in school? Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph.
Well, that's a million-dollar question, but I would just say in response to Joseph, I remember asking my own mentors as I was going into, I didn't do K-12 teaching, but in law school, trying to figure out what made the difference. And reflecting back on my own experience, what made the difference was actually wanting to do well for a teacher and believing that that teacher wanted me to do well and cared about me, because I think we're all humans, right, we obviously all are humans, and we want to maintain our social bonds unless someone has wronged us. And so leveraging that social bond of human interaction and caring about one another is one of the most powerful factors in how a child does in school and how they behave in school. And when we treat them as something other than that, as Joseph suggests, we lose that leverage. I wish, you know, I wish I could say here's how you create good, you know, personal bonds with all our children. But I think it certainly starts with caring about them as individuals. So I think I get the sense that Joseph knows the answer to his question. But he wants somebody with a, you know, a PhD to give him a study. I think he sounds like he's on the right track.
He'll be fine once he gets in the classroom, right? Has a little bit of experience under his belt.
I think that's right. Although I shouldn't minimize the fact that managing a classroom is complicated, and being trained in classroom management is certainly helps you bring out your show your care for children.
Yeah, and that's we only have a minute left, but it's so true that being a teacher is such a complicated profession, and you have to know what's going on with children to be able to deal with some of their discipline problems too. It's just what a hard thing. What a hard thing it is, and they deserve our support and our respect.
I would agree with that. I have trouble with just managing two at home sometimes, so I know that managing 20 or 30 at the same time is certainly tough.
Thank you so much for being with us, Derek.
Thank you.
Derek Black, the book is Ending Zero Tolerance, The Crisis of Absolute School Discipline. Derek is a professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this program, and to Scotty Myers as well. And thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in Milwaukee for all of your calls. Lots of calls coming in this hour. It's good. Thank you very much. We're with you again Monday. All things political, or all things political these days. The first hour of the program. And hour two, time versus money. Which one would you rather have? We'll talk about that.